From the Vaults, audio from Edmonton's past.
This recording consists of an interview of Dr. Kenneth S. Penifold conducted by John McIsaac on October 27, 1980. This material was recorded on a 5-inch open reel tape and was digitized by an archivist on November 17, 2020.
Well, what, date of birth and stuff like that?
That's what we'll start with.
Oh, I see.
Let's do an introduction here. Our interview today is with Dr. Kenneth S. Penifold, Director of Environmental Health Services for the city. Doctor, you were born here in Edmonton.
Yeah, that's right.
In what year was that?
Well, I'll have to be honest, that was May 17th, 1920.
Really?
Mm-hmm. 60 years ago today. Well, not today, but...
Pretty darn close.
Yeah.
See, I understand your father was a postman?
Yeah, Dad was a postman with the post office.
Mm-hmm. And his name was Ken as well?
No, Arthur Thomas.
I see,
yeah.
I see. And your mother, I don't believe she worked outside of the home, did she?
No, Mom stayed in the home. Well, of course, Mother went blind when I was quite young. So, being the youngest in the family, I got to spend quite a bit of time helping Mother at home. Mm-hmm. And I think that way came to understand some of the feelings, the fears and whatnot that blind people have. It was, looking back on it, I realized as a kid I felt that it was a bit of an imposition, but now I can see it was a really great learning experience.
Indeed. Did you not have any brothers and sisters, or did you?
One sister that was 10 years older. So with that kind of a span, I was the obnoxious kid brother.
You grew up, I understand, in the 95th Street area around 106th Avenue?
Yes, well, the address was 10563 on 93rd Street, right across from the old city stables then,
mm-hmm.
when we had the old ash carts pulled by horses.
And, well, that area today is a so-called ethnic area.
Well, it was ethnic then,
mm-hmm.
because this was the home of the Jewish community in that area. An awful lot of the kids that I went to school with were Jewish, and growing up with them was really a wonderful experience,
mm-hmm.
because I think it's the only way you can understand the ethnic Jewish community. It was great.
Indeed. In addition to helping at home, I understand you had a part-time job even then, delivering groceries. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, yes. I was delivering groceries for, it used to be Drummond's Grocery on, what would that be, 95th Street and about 103A Avenue. And prior to that, I was delivering journals down in that end of town. And of course, this was just when social credit was coming in. The Edmonton Journal was anti-social credit. And man, oh man, I had to get down on my knees to retain customers, because in those days, if you had too many lost customers, there was someone else to take over the paper route.
Mm-hmm.
And we made 5 cents per house per week, you know, if everyone paid.
Which was a substantial sum during...
Oh, it was. Sure, it was good.
And, of course, you went to school. I understand you went to Macaulay?
Yes, I started at Macaulay, and then over to Victoria Composite.
And you graduated from there?
Well, I don't know exactly about the graduation from Victoria High. I got out of there. And, well, no, I couldn't say I graduated, because I wanted, after the war, to go down to the Veterinary College at Guelph. And I found that my entrance requirements were not quite good enough, so I was able to take 1 year of agriculture over here at our University of Alberta, and then go down east.
I see. Before you did join the Royal Canadian Air Force, I understand you worked for a plumbing firm here in town?
Yeah, that was kind of a funny thing. Previous to that, I tried out for CJCA. And spent a week on the evening graveyard shift. They decided then that they could use me as, what was it now, control room operator and part-time announcer for the princely sum of $10 a week. Well, you know, we laugh now, but that was pretty good money then. But I guess I was always a larcenous little beggar, And I found a plumbing outfit, boy, that would pay me $12.50. So I jumped. So what I've said to the media in the past, that you see, plumbing's loss was really radio's gain.
Perhaps. But you did join the Royal Canadian Air Force or the Royal Air Force?
No, Royal Canadian.
I think what year was that? Did you join up?
Oh, boy. I think that'd be about 41.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure of the exact date.
And what position did you hold with them?
Well, I thought I was going in as pilot or observer standard. That was the designation. And I got out to the Manning Depot here, out of the old exhibition grounds, mm-hmm. being used then. And lo and behold, I found that with the stroke of an eraser, I had been reclassified as general duty standard. Well, that was the lowest of the low, the Joe Boys. And it took a heck of a long time before I finally got a remuster back into air crew again.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I wound up on the Alaskan coast with a squadron up there.
Is that Ketchikan, I think?
Well, that's an Indian term. It's near Ketchikan.
Yeah.
It was Annette Island. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that the natives on this Annette Island, which is out from Ketchikan, it's in American territory, they originally came from northern BC, and they have a town there, Metlakatla. Now, that is the most up-to-date town that I can ever remember seeing. Now, we were on the island, there was a Canadian Air Force and U.S. Army, but we were not allowed over on the other half of the island. That was out of bounds. And in that these people came from the north part of the Charlottes, they invited us over one evening. Well, I guess I was quite arrogant because I felt that I was being big about going over to this native village. We went into a Presbyterian church. The place was beautiful. Inside, the use of naturally cedar up there, it was beautiful. There was an organist there, a lovely big organ. So she said that prior to the people arriving, that could she play us any tunes? Well, it was her offhand manner that shook me, because trying to be a smart apple, I said, yes, what about Hans the flute player? She thought for a second. Now she said, do you mean Hans the flute player by so-and-so? Or do you mean the magic flute by somebody else? I didn't have a clue. I was absolutely flattened. But we had a wonderful evening over there.
Sure.
The most advanced Indian people that I've ever seen. And I think what it made me realize is that, darn it, if one group can do it, others can. And the homes on that island, beautiful modern homes. It was really a treat to see it.
Sure. Did you actually go overseas during the war period?
No, I didn't. Here again, I seem to get fouled up all over the place. I finally got this remuster into air crew, and we were okayed to solo. We were going to solo the next day. This was down at Assiniboia in southern Saskatchewan. Then, lo and behold, the word came out, the war is nearly over, the British Commonwealth air training plan is cancelled. So I still have my old flight logbook at home. It says okay to solo, but I never did make it. And then, of course, we were dispersed. Well, the next posting was down to De Burt, Nova Scotia. And, being down on the East Coast, I could see myself literally waiting till hell froze over, you know, before I got released. And we were married at that time, so I wanted to get back home.
Oh, you married before the war was over?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You were married to Elizabeth Delaney?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and still happily married.
Oh, yes, you? Yes. Well, I tell you, we're both at the stage now where, high mileage unit, who would want us? But, so what I did in order to get out of the Air Force, we had a very kindly medical doctor down at the base, so he gave me a discharge, of all things, for flat feet. So that's how I got my freedom.
Indeed. And you came back to Edmonton.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. I understand you and Elizabeth have three children?
Yes, three.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And at that point, you decided to continue your education.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand
yes.
that you enrolled at the University of Alberta.
Yeah, for that 1 year in agriculture.
Right. Is it at that point that you decided to become a veterinarian?
No, I had wanted it for quite some time. I don't think I ever really realized why I wanted it, but it's just that I did want it. And I think during the working years and in the service years, I saw that unless a person had something behind them, that they weren't going to get very far.
So you did the 1 year at the U of A,
mm-hmm.
then you went down to the University of Guelph?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you took, what, three more years?
4 years. 4 years down there in veterinary medicine,
mm-hmm.
graduating in 1950.
Mm-hmm. And you came back to Alberta?
Oh, yes, to Riley.
Yeah, I understand you had an independent practice there.
Yes, it was an independent practice. I was there from 50 to 53. And then I came up and joined the city.
At Riley, what sort of, you know, veterinary type problems did you
have? Oh, well, this was mainly large animal, cattle predominantly, and with the odd smattering of small animal thrown in.
Then you did join the city as a meat inspector.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, there were a number of plants, processing plants, in the city at the time.
Yes, we had three under city inspection. There was Capital Packers. They have since gone under federal inspection. And there was Victoria Packers. They went bankrupt. And then there was Chester D. Gaynor, which was a brother of the original Gaynor crew here in town. And, well, I guess under my careful guidance, they finally closed the plant down.
Gaynor's plant?
Yeah, the small Gaynor's plant.
Mm-hmm. There was also a sausage plant in the city, was there
not? Oh, yes, there were, there was two. There was 101st Street Meat Market. That was Ernst Schmolke. Now he's since expanded and done very well since coming over from Germany. And then there was a Vann's sausage. Well, Vann still has a couple of small outlets in the city, but his main plant is now under federal inspection. That was J.F. Vanderveld, a Dutch fellow.
How is it determined what who would have the inspection power over these places?
Well, you see, at that time, we didn't have any provincial meat inspection. That came later. I worked with, provincial agriculture, and particularly Dr. Jim O'Donoghue, who's the assistant deputy minister. And but prior to that, you had municipal inspection and you had federal inspection, and there was nothing in between the two to look after the smaller plants that were really not large enough, you know, have a large enough volume to go under federal inspection. So this is how we came up in, oh golly, that'd be about 1972. Started towards this Provincial Meat Inspection Act.
Yeah.
And so now you have slaughterhouses all over the province, small ones catering to local needs, but the meat is now inspected and passed.
And what were your duties at the time?
Well, at the time I had the three plants to look after, reports to submit to City Hall. This was during Dr. Mel Little's time as Medical Officer of Health. And then, through contact with the public health inspectors, I became more and more involved with them. And I realized that their understanding of meat hygiene, meat bacteriology and stuff like that, was a little lacking. So gradually this closer alliance between myself and the inspectors came about, and I guess one thing led to another, and here I am today heading up the health inspection section.
Would the diseases at the time be different from the diseases today in the packing plants?
No, not really. No, they were the same. And when you get into the poultry field, we have a great hoofla today on salmonella, salmonella in poultry. We had it then. And there isn't that much new in the disease field, really, you know, that is transmissible to humans.
Were there other inspectors as well doing the same sort of work as you?
No, I was the only one with the city.
You were it?
Yeah, I was it.
Indeed. Now, you mentioned earlier you knew Chester Gaynor.
Oh, yes, you know, quite well.
I see you had a few battles with him, I'm sure.
Well, you know, the poor old Chester, his time was finally up a little while ago. He's gone now. But I admired the man, because he would stand up and fight like merry old hell. Mm-hmm. But he didn't hold a grievance. And I'll never forget the day in my office when he came up to see me. I've forgotten who else was in there. And he had decided to shut the plant down because it couldn't come up to standards that were required then. And I was helping the old gentleman on with his coat. And I used to call him the Uncle Shaster, because this one Jewish meat peddler couldn't pronounce Chester, so it came out Shaster. So I said, "Oh, come on, Uncle Shaster." I said, we've battled before. And he just wheeled around when I was helping him put his coat on, and he says, "Yes, but never eyeball to eyeball." And he was one of the, well, the definite characters that we had a few years ago that called a shovel a shovel. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't the nicey-nicey political approach or anything like that.
Now, you said he decided to close the plant down. Mm-hmm. I take it then that 14 years or so that you were a meat inspector, that the standards were improved.
Oh, yes.
Or made more rigorous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you recall any changes in standards offhand?
Well, it was an ever-increasing demand for better sanitation, better refrigeration, things like that. Mm-hmm. That just natural progress with time. And the plant was a real old one. It had been Morrison and Huff years ago. Well, it was right next to the, or just east of, the stockyards, just practically sitting on their property. It was an old wooden building, and it was just past its time.
And then in 1967, you became the Director of Environmental Health Services?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I see. And could you just tell us what the structure of that job was at the time? Like, what were you expected to do in 1967?
Well, actually, I was looking after, I guess, if you want to use a fancy term, food control, as well as working with the public health inspectors.
Mm-hmm. And who would you be responsible to?
Oh, directly to the medical officer of health.
I see, in here in the city?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the city paid your wages at the time?
Yes, we were part of the city then. But since then, we have changed over, and we're no longer the city health department, but we're the Edmonton Local Board of Health, or if you wish, the Local Board of Health for the city of Edmonton. And our funding is now 100% provincial.
I understand that at the time, there were a number of problems with your job, that in that you didn't, for instance, have power to prosecute offenders. Is that true or not?
Oh, yes, yes, this is true, that the prosecution was kind of a, how shall I describe it? Well, nice people didn't do those sort of things. That this was the approach. And I could sense the frustration on the part of the inspectors, you know, because education is fine. And as a father of three kids, education is fine, but there has to be a point where the child gets a whack across the butt. And this is where I saw prosecution coming in. And granted, today we still use it as a last resort. If the educational approach doesn't work, then the inspector has a club behind his back that whereby he can say, now look, do it or else.
Would the charge be laid under federal legislation or provincial? I presume by this time there was provincial legislation.
Oh yes, yes. The charge would be laid under provincial legislation. And actually the ability to lay charges had been in health legislation for donkey's years, mm-hmm. but no one had used it.
I see. Then, now you have a number of big campaigns to your credit, and I think perhaps the biggest is your campaign against high bacteria counts in hamburger. How did that start?
Well, there again, you see, down at Guelph at the Veterinary College, we took an awful lot of bacteriology and an awful lot of pathology, because as a rural veterinarian out in the country, you do not have an up-to-date laboratory at your elbow. So you have to understand a little more of the nature of bacteria. So this food bit kind of fell into that pattern. We were picking up random samples of hamburger and various meats like this.
Now you were picking them up at restaurants?
Usually retail stores. Mm-hmm. And we found the results pretty terrible. And I suppose after looking at these for a while, then I got the goofy idea that why could we not set a standard, an acceptable standard? And that, of course, involved more sampling and stuff like that, and the inspectors helped out, bringing in samples from their areas, things like this. And, I don't know, gradually the whole thing just kind of fell into place. So that the board was able to come out with a suggested standard. And now if we find a sample of food that, say, coming out of a restaurant or out of a meat operation that is not up to snuff, then the inspector has something. He can show the person this sheet. Now look, this is what is considered acceptable. And Ottawa has more or less accepted our viewpoint here, as has provincial health.
Well, I understand that the campaign that you more or less started resulted in a federal symposium on bacteria in hamburger. Is that not the case?
Yes, that's true. I'd kind of forgotten about that. That was, that'd be about 72, I think, or something like that. Hmm. Yes, I had an invitation down to Ottawa, and all the big brass were there from the canning companies and everything else, and I was quite honored to be invited. I didn't know what the heck I was doing there, but...
So I think one could assume that this idea of having an actual count that it would be acceptable has now spread to other provinces as well.
Oh yes, yes. I think the approach has been recognized down in the States as well.
Really?
But we haven't yet, developed the intestinal fortitude of making these standards legally required. You know, they're a recommended standard now. I would like to see them become enshrined in legislation.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you would go to a retail or even a wholesale meat outlet to get samples. Would you announce that you were coming, or would you simply...
No, just walk in and knock on the counter and surprise, look who's here.
I see, I'm sure you've had many surprised faces upon occasion.
Yes, and I've had some rather adverse comment, too.
Sure. Well, have you ever been denied access to samples?
One chap was going to try it, but then after a stormy discussion, he decided that, what the heck.
Well, by law, I believe that you are allowed to enter.
Yes, we're allowed to enter and inspect, you know, any retail premises, but the actual physical taking of a sample, it's a little dicey. So if my inspectors are going to do any sampling today, they will ask the person if they would voluntarily submit a sample. If not, then they will purchase a sample. So you see, as a customer, they can't be denied the right to purchase.
I'm sure. Yeah. In places like that, retail outlets or restaurants, what other sorts of things do you look for when you make an inspection for health?
Well, basically, sanitation. Sanitation in the food handling area, that is of prime importance. Now that means cleanliness, safekeeping of perishable foods under refrigeration. And with cooked foods, say, keep them hot or keep them cold. That is below 40, using the old Fahrenheit scale, or above 140.
Mm-hmm. And it would include other things like sneeze-proof?
Sneeze guards, yes. This is out in the servery area. So that if you and I walked in and had a cold and we sneezed and barked, then the germs would not be spread over the foodstuff.
Well, is that not a more recent development, having these sorts of guards out?
Yes, it is, quite recent.
Is that a result of your efforts, or?
Oh, well, not only mine. The Inspectors Institute here in Alberta saw the value of it as well. So they went behind the push.
Your terms of reference goes beyond food, though. I take it you have an interest in slum housing, or perhaps appropriately an interest in proper housing.
Yeah, mm-hmm, true. This also falls under provincial legislation. And for a while there, we had a housing section in the health department that was starting to do routine inspections of rental accommodation. We've had to drop the routine approach because we just do not have the manpower. And in a way, this openness campaign that we've been on, you know, relative to the news media, where we tell them what we're doing and everything else, that has kind of boomeranged. Because what we're finding now is more and more requests. It seems that the public sees us as a credible entity that can possibly do something. So the demand is getting heavier and heavier all the time, and I just don't have the complement of staff to really be doing the things that we would like to be doing.
So someone who's living in what they suspect to be substandard housing might call you up and ask you to inspect the place?
Oh yes. Now, we would take this as a complaint, and the way we've been running is complaints receive first priority. And then routine inspections, restaurants and whatnot. I've got a darn good crew of men, and they're able, somehow, I still don't know how, but they're able to handle all of these complaints and at the same time see that their restaurant operations, food operations, don't get too far behind.
And what sorts of things would make a house, unacceptable as far as...
Well, of course, damage to walls and ceilings, water leakage, improper ceiling height, improper window area relative to floor area. And of course, we're now having this same problem with some of the daycare institutions. And it seems that the daycare operators want a different standard, a lesser standard than is required under housing regulations, you know, for rooms that you're sleeping in, and also in the Alberta Building Code. Now, the daycare operators are really trying to cut corners, and of course, well, once again, we have another battle going. Our feeling is that if housing regulations call for this relationship between window area and floor area in a room, the building code, both provincial and federal, calls for the same thing. Well then, darn it, I don't think it can be a wrong move to request the same in daycare.
Yeah, how about something like bugs, like cockroaches?
Oh, well, any infestation, then the health inspector will order the owner of the property to disinfest. And if need be, he'll give the owner what we call an executive officer's order. You know, if he senses that the educational approach isn't going to get through, then he can issue a letter to that landlord giving him X number of days to accomplish this feat. Then, if the operator or owner does not bring this about within that specified time, then the health inspector can take him into court. So this is just a little prelude. Court time, the preparation leading up to it, is really time consuming. So we're trying to cut down on that by the use of these executive officer's orders. And these are the orders that are open to the news media because they're posted on the bulletin board in our office.
Now, that in itself was a real step forward, the idea of where an investigation has taken place and some action is being taken. At one time, this was not made public.
Oh, heavens no. And it was a long uphill battle to bring about this freedom of information bit that we have.
With whom were you battling?
Administration. And I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay.
But I think now I can be quite truthful about it. I was talking to, as I call him, old sweetness and light, Eddie Keene from CHED. Mm-hmm. And I expressed dismay over the fact that we had this absolute reluctance to release any information. Well, it seems that old sweetness and light got talking to Alderman Ron Hayter. Alderman Hayter brought it up at council. Council said, yes, it'd be a wonderful move. So the motion came over to the local Board of Health. I think the board was somewhat stunned by this approach. They couldn't really see anything wrong with it. So they passed it. And here we have it. We're the first health unit in Canada to bring about this openness of information policy. And it's really been a wonderful thing.
And of course, it could be an asset to restaurants and retailers too, in that if their place was inspected and nothing did appear, charges or that sort of thing, they don't say so. And over the years, there's been a number of rumors about restaurants, especially Chinese restaurants.
Oh, certainly.
Serving usually animals.
No, I have truthfully, sure, I've battled the Chinese about the method of holding barbecue meat brownies. But I must say that we have never encountered any cat or dog or horse or anything like that in there. This is just a wild, vicious rumor.
Exactly, and this freedom of information would show that indeed it is isn't it?
So. Yeah, it does. And then I've got to say, really, that the news media have been terribly, terribly supportive. You know, starting, say, with the Journal, there was Terry McDonald, and then Andy Imlach took over after Terry. And of course, did you know that Andy Imlach is now leaving the Journal?
I wasn't aware of that.
Oh, he's got quite a posh position for himself over in London with a paper called The Parliamentarian. And I think, I don't know how often this is published, I think maybe once or twice a month. And it's all on parliamentary affairs, and it's distributed throughout, you might say the English-speaking world, and some of the other countries as well, as I understand. So it's quite a step forward, but we're sure going to miss him and the support that he's given us.
Is it much of an asset to maintain good health standards in the fact that Alberta is more or less rat-free? The sightings of rats are very rare around here.
Yeah.
How does that relate generally to the standard of health in the city?
Oh, it does help, very definitely. But we still get the odd rat sneaking in, you know, in a boxcar from the coast or something like that, or maybe in a boxcar coming from down east. And really, the prospect of rat-free Alberta, the fellows in provincial agriculture deserve a world of credit and praise for the work they've done. The establishment of this 10-mile-wide poison bait area on the eastern Alberta border between here and Saskatchewan has worked wonders. Now, mind you, it's cost a lot to maintain it, but it's certainly proved its usefulness. And then, it's a matter of cooperation. The crews at the railroad yards that are unloading cars, you know, coming in from the coast, that is, rail cars of goods, the boys on the unloading crew will usually have a length of 2x4 handy in case they see a rat and they'll nail him. Well, that was fine, but the CNR downtown were quite annoyed a few years back because there was a shipment of Japanese motorbikes came through from the coast. Some of the unloading crew got a little wild with their 2x4s. There were a fair number of smashed headlights, but they got the rat that was in the boxcar.
I'm sure they did.
They had a lot of fun too.
Do you dissect or those rats when they're discovered? Or?
No. It's just a matter of disposing of the carcass. That's all. Hmm. Because the rat as a carrier of disease is really not as great as we might think. More of an incidental carrier. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, in that we don't have any here, we don't have to worry that much about the rat. Now, how long our luck is going to last, I don't know. But I sure hope that Alberta Agriculture keeps up the work they've been doing.
You mentioned earlier, Doctor, that you just don't have enough staff to do everything that you'd like to do. Could you compare the complement of staff that you have now as opposed to, say, when you started, in 53?
Oh, Gloria, I haven't thought about that.
I'm sure it's improved.
Oh, it has improved, but then you see our workload has improved. Mm-hmm. And, or increased, I should say. And then the acceptance, I guess, by John Q. Public and the utilization of us as a referral source for complaints. Because, as they say, well, you can get something done. This thing, as I say, is boomeranged, because now other governmental agencies and also segments of the city are phoning up, well, can you help us out with this or can you help us out with that? Well, we're getting in so deep, we can't see shore from where we're standing. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that the province will appreciate the work that my gang are doing and provide funding for additional staff so that we can get a proper job done. Because I'll be the first to admit that a lot of work that we should be doing, we just physically can't due to manpower shortage.
You also mentioned earlier that there was a lack of provincial legislation at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, we do have one act that I'm familiar with, the Provincial Meat Inspection Act.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, is there any other legislation, that's really well known?
Oh, yes. There's housing legislation. There's food and drink legislation. There's restaurant legislation, housing legislation. Nuisances and general sanitation, there's quite a few of them there that we have to work with. Now, a lot of them, of course, need updating. Times, conditions have changed.
For a while, I understand you were working here in the city under a 1917 city bylaw.
Oh, that was the old 1917 bylaw, yeah. Well, we finally, there again, the city decided to do some housekeeping. So we scrapped an awful lot of the old bits and pieces, you know, about horses and horse-drawn traffic through the city and stuff like that. It's now redundant. So we were able to whittle an awful lot out of the old public health bylaw.
And you and your staff helped to make new bylaws, I take it?
Oh, yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Provide input if anyone cares to ask us. We're happy to do it.
Now, in 1975, you received a rather prestigious award, an honorary membership in the Canadian Institute of Public Health Inspection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is very, very rare for a veterinarian.
Yes, it is, because, it's something, I recall it so clearly. You know, I've been working with the public health inspectors for so long, and to me, this was acceptance by, I felt, a wonderful group of people. And my gosh, with that, you can't ask for anything more. I figured if they're willing to take me in, I must have done something right.
Well, I think your fame spread. Have you received other awards or appreciation?
Well, I have to be honest that just a little while ago, I received the Sanitarian of the Year Award for 1980 from the Alberta branch of, it was the International Association, well, it's the Alberta branch of the International Association of Milk, Food, and Environmental Sanitarians. So that just capped off my career.
Yes, you have a few things I'm sure you would like to see changed, sometime. I understand you would very much like to have a licensing for restaurateurs to be a little bit more difficult, that they should be more trained.
Well, you see, this is the screwy part. You know, you see these fallacies in life. Now, if you or I wanted to be a tinsmith, a plumber, something like this, the law says, hey, fella, you've got to pass a training course and become qualified. But if you wanted to open a restaurant tomorrow, whoopee-ding, away you go, I'm a cook, without any proof of training. Now, I'm hoping that this can be changed provincially. I understand, unofficially, that there is a bit of a move in that direction.
Well, you did win one of your former battles in that you wanted very much to have some legislation for the shipment of food in trucks, especially.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Now, you did win that battle, did you not?
Yeah, we got lucky there. Yeah. And that is firmly entrenched in legislation right now.
I see. And exactly what does that involve?
Well, it means that you keep perishable foods, be they hot or cold, out of what we call the monkey round zone, between 40 degrees and 140 degrees Fahrenheit. In other words, you keep it cold below 40, or keep it hot above 140. And that is now law.
And the biggest complaint from them at the time was that it would be too expensive.
Oh, Lord, yes. The cries of anguish is really heartrending. And I said, well, I'm a miserable, cantankerous old coot. I believe in it, so I'm going to fight for it.
Well, as in all of these sort of health movements, the rafts and the shipment of food, any expense is really paying for itself, is it not, in the long run, in that, you know, like with rafts, there's less grain loss. I would imagine with the shipment of food, there'd be, less food loss.
Oh, certainly, yeah. But then, you see, what you're doing is you're asking someone to put out some bucks for protection. Now, he sees that, as far as his financial income is concerned, as a loss, a monetary loss. So he's going to fight it. So you've got to try and educate him. Well, if you can get his arm behind his back and twist it and get him to say, Uncle, well, you know, your educational approach moves that more rapidly.
If one goes through the records here at the archives, Doctor, especially with regards to health matters, we see a long history of epidemics and, you know, really bad spread of illnesses mm-hmm. throughout the years.
Yeah.
In your time, has there been anything very serious, say, since 53? Like, I would imagine, for instance, polio was quite a bad one in the 50s.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. Well, of course, I think you've got to separate communicable disease from diseases transmitted by foodstuffs, you know, like the common cold, the flu, and stuff like that. That's off into an entirely different field. But I think I can safely say that, here in Edmonton, a proven report of food poisoning is pretty doggone rare. And I think the credit has to go to the health inspectors out in the field. Because, sure, maybe I'm forming the bullets, but they're the ones that are doing the firing out in the field. And I think it's credit to them.
I see. So as far as humans are concerned, we're okay. How about on the other side? How about with the other animals? For instance, cattle and chickens and so on.
Well, I tell you, I've been away from the strict veterinary field for a long period of time, and I'm really not up on that phase of it. I've been devoting more time to food control and things like that. So I'm a little rusty. And of course, there are always exotic new conditions cropping up in the in the field of food animals, like cattle. And also in another byproduct, milk. And there again, the inspection crew have to be constantly on their toes.
For these new
new
illnesses.
Yeah, so that are coming along.
I would take it there'd have to be a fair amount of in-house training then with your staff.
Yes, and this is the one, I suppose, hope or dream that I have. You see, my health inspectors now do get wonderful training at, I'd say British Columbia Institute of Technology, or there's Ryerson Institute down in Toronto. But this is just a 2-year course. And what I find happening is that my men are having to deal with more and more complex problems. So what I would like to see is, rather than an inspector come out right out of school with a degree, the equivalent of a bachelorate, as is done in United Kingdom now and in United States, I would like to see the present 2-year course kept on for a while. But in the meantime, have some provision for the inspectors to, say, take 6 months off and achieve credit for training in specific fields, such as noise. Well, here again, it's a pretty heavy field. And food processing as well, in that we have to now look into some pretty advanced types of food processing in the city. And I would like to see this training of the inspectors expanded.
What's in the future for you, Doctor? There's been rumors that you might simply retire. There's also rumors that you might go to work for the World Health Organization or the Canadian International Development Agencies.
Well, golly, I don't know. I tell you, right now, Mom and I are planning a 3-month vacation. 1 month in Fiji and 2 months in New Zealand. So that'll bring us back mid-February of 1981. I will come back for 1 day's work. I'll admit I'm not going to do any work on that day, though. That's February the 20th, and that'll be it. Then after that, I want to be a bum for a while to do what I feel like doing, if and when I feel like doing it. I guess it's freedom that I'm looking for. Now, how long I'll be content with that freedom, heavens only knows. And I don't know what opportunities I might have. I've had a couple of offers from the media, but I don't want to get into that. You're back into this pressure situation again. And truthfully, I don't know who would want me, because I can promise one thing, that I won't change. I'll still be as hard-nosed and bull-headed as ever.
Well, whatever you choose, Doctor, I'm sure you'll do well. Thank you very much for this interview today.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
This material is a digitized audio recording from the holdings of the City of Edmonton Archives. For more information regarding the recording, please contact us by email at cms.archives@edmonton.ca, by phone at 780-496-8711, or on our online catalog at cityarchives.edmonton.ca.